You start?
Yeah,
I will
okay.
join.
Do you see everything the way you should see it? So you
yes,
see
very
the
clear.
You see the presentation, but not the notes mess in the back, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so today we will talk about the English article system, which is the bane of the existence of many foreign language learners of English, especially of those foreign language learners who don't have articles in their mother tongue. And I recall taking this picture when we were at the ICLC conference in Japan in 2019. And it says tickets are valid on a day you bought. And that's absolutely impossible in English. So it sometimes seems to native speakers of English or native speakers of languages that do have articles that learners of those languages are intent on making the most impossible errors. And if there are two or three possible options, they will select the fourth one, and that's the one that absolutely doesn't fit. So because in our project, we want to see whether we can develop better ways of describing native speaker knowledge and also of using those insights to improve language learning, we have selected a number of case studies that deal with topics that L2 learners really struggle with. And one of these topics is articles, another one is tense, which we will talk about on Friday. So I want to remind you of our disclaimers. So when we do this computational modeling, we don't want to model the phenomenon as well as we possibly can. If we would want to do that, we would use some very advanced engineering technique, deep learning mechanisms, but we want to do it as cognitively plausible as possible. So we want to make the same errors. Ideally, we want to make the same errors that learners make or that native speakers make, because that way we can learn most about the cognitive dimension of their knowledge, so to speak. And we're also not saying, as I've mentioned a few times throughout this series, that learning is the ultimate answer to all problems in linguistics, but learning has potential and it's been ignored. And it has specifically a good potential to help us demystify emergence. So how would linguistic knowledge emerge from exposure to usage? And if we look at something that can emerge from usage, then what shape does that knowledge take? And the zero article in English are indeed quite a problem. So these articles are very rare, or these article systems are very rare across languages. So if you see here on the slide, I put a map of the WALS, the World Atlas of Linguistic Structures, and I presented a map where they summarize the languages that have article systems. And all of the yellow triangles indicate languages that they've studied that have no trace of an article system at all. As you can see, those languages that do have article systems are concentrated in Western Europe. Overall, it seems to be the case that only 8% of all languages spoken across the world have definite and indefinite article systems. Some languages have definite systems, but no indefinite systems, etc. But the combination of both is pretty much only attested in Western Europe. And the frustrating bit is that in languages, so Western European languages, including English and Spanish and German, in those languages, articles are the most frequently used words. You have to use an article every time you use a noun. And basically that means that if you speak a Germanic or a Romance language, then every fifth word you produce, hear or read is an article. Unfortunately, this system seems to be very hard to master for foreign language learners of English. It's in the literature, it has been flagged up as one of the most difficult aspects of grammar, and one of the latest to be fully acquired by L2 learners who are native speakers of languages that do not mark articles. So it seems to be that it's not clear why we have such problems. It's a simple three-way choice. You either use the, you use a, or you use the zero article, but there don't seem to be any reliable rules to guide foreign language learners. So this use of articles has for a very long time been studied, but it has defied accurate description. And as part of a project, we look through a number of pedagogical grammars, so grammars of English for learners of English. And we found that the grammars don't agree on how the grammatical category is described or should be described. And that most of these grammatical explanations focus on a concept that's specificity, which refers to the fact whether the speaker refers to a particular thing or not. And that doesn't seem to be a rule that works particularly well. And alongside these rules that don't really work very well, there's also reliance on extensive lists of very specific usage instances. So people or students will be told that the you need to use the with river, so it's the river sheaf, but you cannot use the with lakes. It's not the Lake Como, it's Lake Como. But when it's plural, you can say the, it's the Great Lakes. So this is very confusing. Three types or three names for water, or well, two actually, a river and lake. Some take the, some cannot take the, some must take the, and this goes on. So when you look at names of countries, you cannot say the England, but you have to say the Azores. And allegedly that's because the Azores are a group of islands, but Japan is also a group of islands and you cannot say the Japan. So, and on we go. It's the same with sports. You cannot play the tennis, but you have to play the guitar. So it's no surprise then that, you know, learners of English get really confused and frustrated with this particular aspect of English grammar. So what I want you to do to get you to think a little bit about this is I want to give you a sentence, and I would like you to think about the article that you think is missing in this context. So I'll give you half a minute to read the sentence, and then if you can decide for yourselves which article is missing, either nothing or the, then I will show you the answer. So we asked a number of native speakers of English to supply the missing article. In fact, we asked about 60 native speakers of English which article they think is missing. So in the context, don't be shocked at how gormless students can be. They'd have to be or they wouldn't cheat, right? One left a sales receipt from the essay mail in his book, another one sent, and all native speakers in our group said that the only possible answer here would be on. So another sent an army of male students pretending to be him to sit his exams. But if I show you the next sentence, what do you think the missing article would be? So when we checked the answers that our native speakers of English provided, we got a very different picture. So we got 15 people who said, you don't need anything. You can say free school advocate and journalist Toby Young recently joined other business executives. Then we had 20 people who said, you need to use a. So a free school advocate and journalist Toby Young recently joined other business executives. And we had 24 people who said that you need to say the free school advocate and journalist Toby Young recently joined other business executives. So in this context, all three options are possible. And those of you who are advanced learners of English will know that that's indeed the case. But there is a very slight meaning difference between those three options. The question, of course, is what that meaning difference really is. And you will remember from the previous lectures that we like to use our learning algorithm to see what can be learned from exposure to the data alone. But when we did that for this article data set, so when we let the algorithm learn just from word co-occurrences, we found that actually our algorithm wasn't able to get anything right. So I give you just briefly the results of what we obtained. The model wasn't able to get anything right. I think it scored in less than 10% of all cases. It was able to retrieve the article that native speakers had preferred in the context, so to speak. And that's with the algorithm that learns from data the way humans do. We have a computer scientist who's associated with the team, and he's very much into deep learning models. And he said, well, I think deep learning models will, you know, do much better at this. And they indeed got an excellent result. I think the deep learning models got about 90% of all of the choices correct. But of course, they've been trained over, you know, immense numbers of words, and they have unlimited memory and attention, and that's definitely not human. So knowing that those models can solve this task doesn't really help us understand how human beings solve this task. But as you will remember, at the core of this learning algorithm is the fact that you don't learn from only positive evidence, but also from negative evidence, so from the errors you make. And we decided we'd learn from this failure, so to speak, following Yoda, and see what we, you know, take a step back and look again at the data and see what exactly we would have to incorporate to make our model perform better. And that's one of the things that's an advantage or a disadvantage of computational modeling. It forces you to be really very explicit about the inputs, about the information that you learn from and that you base your decisions on. So the failure of our algorithm showed that article use is not learnable by forming associations between articles and other words in the sentence. But the question is then, what information do we need to give the algorithm so that it can learn articles from data? From exposure to data, so to speak, what kind of information does the model need to have access to? And as cognitive linguists, you will not be surprised to hear that words used in a sentence kind of conjure up whole worlds. And in cognitive linguistics, these worlds are known as semantic frames, something that Charles Fillmore did a lot of work on. And on a cognitive linguistic approach, the meanings of words are an extension of our rich bodily and cultural experiences. And take, for example, the notion of a restaurant. You will all agree that the concept restaurant is associated with a series of other concepts, such as food and service and waiters and table and menu and eating. And these concepts are very intimately related to our understanding of the concept of restaurant. And what our hypothesis was is that knowledge plays an important role in how the grammar of the English article system works. But if we only give our algorithm access to how words co-occur with each other, then they don't have access to this semantic frame, to the information packaged in semantic frames. Now, when we looked through the literature, we found some traces of ways in which this frame-related knowledge had been incorporated into philosophical and linguistic approaches to the problem of articles. And typically, this information was packaged through two new concepts. So researchers would use or refer to the concept of reference specificity and hearer knowledge. And, you know, those concepts do what they, you know, what it says on the tin. So the reference specificity captures whether the speaker is referring to a specific thing, and hearer knowledge captures whether the hearer knows what the speaker is referring to. These two variables have also been very popular in research on second language learning. So when you look through the literature on how articles should be taught to foreign learners of English, you will immediately come across these two variables in exactly the configuration that you see on the slide. So it's called the semantic wheel. And the semantic wheel consists of four parts, and which are combinations of specificity of referent and hearer knowledge, and either this variable or this information is present or it is absent, and you get four combinations in total. Specificity of referent in particular has played a major role in the literature on first language acquisition and second language learning. And learners appear to find, or the data that's available from language learners appears to show that this concept is quite intuitive, to the extent that some linguists have claimed that specificity must be an innate concept. But of course, usage-based linguists don't do innateness, and we need, if we want to say that specificity of a referent is an important parameter, then we need to show that this can be learned from exposure to usage. And what I'm going to tell you now is a corpus-based study that we conducted together with one of our postdocs, Laurence Romain, and this paper is currently under review, so I can't send you the finished version yet. So we set out to investigate this question based on a sample of real usage, which was a random sample of 2,000 sentences extracted from the British National Corpus. We had half of the data was extracted from the spoken data, and the other half of the sample was extracted from the written texts that are available in the BNC. Those 2,000 sentences were manually annotated. We started by annotating just 500. I know some of you have asked a number of times how many examples need to be chosen and et cetera. So that's why I'm going into a little bit more detail about this here. So we started by annotating the first 500 examples, 250 spoken, 250 written. And we used a larger set of variables. So the literature had thrown up a number of variables that might potentially be interesting, and I list them there on the right-hand side in the variables box. So we have reference specificity, hearer knowledge, but also number, and whether it's a count or a mass noun, a common or a proper noun, abstract concrete concept, whether it's used sentence initially or phrase initially, whether there's any further explanation preceding or following the noun, and whether the article is used in a set phrase, so in a fixed expression. So one of our PhD students did the first pass, and after the first 500 instances, she checked intra-rater reliability, so to speak. So she annotated the sample again, and then checked to what extent she had assigned the same labels to those same sentences. And we only retained those variables that could be reliably annotated and that showed a significant relation with the article. So we retained reference specificity, hearer knowledge, number, count mass, elaboration site, and set phrase. The other variables were either very difficult to annotate reliably, or they didn't show any significant relation with the article choice. And then one of our postdocs took over, and she annotated the full data set based on those remaining variables. So 2,000 sentences annotated for the remaining five variables. So to give you an idea of what this looked like, the important point here is that we use sentences in context, not in isolation. So you see that the target sentence here is that slowly the tears subsided and gradually I began to pull myself together. But you see on the slide that we have three sentences that precede and three sentences that follow. And that's because we had just established computationally that the information that you need to make an article choice is not provided within the sentence. So it's somewhere else. If reference specificity and hearer knowledge are important, then you may need information that precedes the sentence, for example. And that information, whether something was known to hearer or not, was actually a very interesting annotating. That was actually a very interesting exercise. So when you get to the tears in the target sentence and you look back through the preceding three sentences, you see that there's actually no literal mention of the word tears, but there is mention of crying. So I sat down in a doorway and continued crying. Of course, when human beings cry, there are tears, and everyone speaking, every speakers of a language know that that is the case. So the tears are known to the hearer, they are expected, and they're also specific. You know that these are going to be the subject's tears running down their own cheeks and not someone else's tears running over some other face. So we annotated this sentence as the tears in this case are known to the hearer because there was talk of crying in the preceding sentence. We also said that this is a specific reference, so we know whose tears we're talking about. And then tears, the noun itself, it's countable, it's plural, and we see that in the sentence there is no further elaboration about tears. So Laurence did this for 2,000 sentences. As you can see, this is quite, this is quite a demanding task. Especially, what is especially demanding is that you are really consistent with how you apply your labels, and that means with how you interpret your variables. If you're not very consistent, it's going to be impossible to spot any patterns in the data. So before moving to the analysis, what I wanted to mention is that we decided to exclude all set phrases from our sample. So set phrases are fixed expressions, which means that they don't behave like the rest of the language because there's no variation possible. Whether you use an a or a the or no article in set phrases is not up to you. It's just the way things are said. In a sense, these set phrases are kind of like lexical items, and they need to be memorized as such. So with the set phrases removed, our sample was quite balanced in terms of articles. So recall that this was a random sample of 2,000 sentences. We didn't try to extract 500 of each, but that's exactly what we found. So we had roughly 550 examples for each article. Our examples weren't just a sentence, but they were what we call discourse chunks, so three preceding sentences and the three following sentences. And we had, those were further split into spoken versus written language. And all of these sentences were annotated for those five properties that I mentioned, so hearer knowledge, specificity of referent, countability, number, and NP elaboration. And we then tested how well that information that's available in the variables would allow us to predict the choice of one of the three articles, or zero. And this is quite a difficult classification task. So we used a statistical classifier to get a grip on the situation. We used a so-called tree and forest model, which finds a path through the data, and then that path becomes your decision sequence. And I'm not going to go into the details, the statistical details, so to speak, because I think you all know these decision trees from silly examples like this one, which helps you to decide when to eat chocolate, a guide for researchers. So in this case, the conclusion is always eat chocolate, but when you do this seriously, so to speak, you actually get useful information. So this is the decision tree for the article data. I remember, excluding set phrases. And what was really surprising is that with this information, we were able to classify more than 93% of all instances correctly. And that's that's really amazing. We were surprised ourselves and checked our results multiple times, but it kept on coming back. And the crucial thing is that in order to make article choice predictable, we need to make hearer knowledge the top variable. So what appears to be the most important piece of information is hearer knowledge, whether the reference or the noun you are referring to is known to the person you're speaking to, rather than reference specificity, which had always been hailed in the literature as the saving grace, so to speak. And once we noticed that, things suddenly started falling into place. And I was joking at the time, and I sent a message to my teammates apologizing because I started to feel like I was looking like a conspiracy theorist more than anything else. But suddenly things started to make sense. And I will talk you through the sense that we found in this data set in the next few slides. So when you look at the classification table that you see here on the slide, you see that classification is done well if all of the highest numbers are in the diagonal. So here I've highlighted the diagonal, the black numbers, which means that if there was a zero in the original text, the zero was also predicted by the model. If there was an a use in the original, the a was also predicted by the model. If the original sentence used the was also predicted by the model. And you can see that there is very little in terms of misprediction. So the vast majority of zero was predicted as zero. You have a few that are predicted as a few that are predicted as the. With a, it's even better. The vast majority is predicted as a. It's never mispredicted as the. Some are mispredicted as zero. And then with the, you have the same again. Vast majority is predicted correctly. Some mispredicted as a, some mispredicted as zero. So overall, zero seems to be the hardest to predict, but it's still done really, really well. And so as I said, we were very pleased with our results. So we checked it a number of times. You can run one classification tree, but you can also construct what they call a forest of trees. So you repeat your procedure a number of times on a different subset of the data. And we got about the same prediction accuracy. So 93.2% came out of the forest. So as I briefly indicated, hearer knowledge was the variable that came out top, so to speak. And you can see on these slides how much prediction accuracy you lose if you remove one of the variables that we had included. So if you remove information that is captured in the variable hearer knowledge, you lose 88% of your prediction accuracy. If you remove the information that's captured in the variable number, so whether the noun is singular or plural, you lose 67% of your prediction accuracy. If you remove information that's captured in the variable count, so whether the noun is countable or not, you lose 57% and so on. So you see then that specificity of referent is not all that important. You lose only 38% of prediction accuracy if you remove that information from the model. And as you can see at the bottom, what we called corpus is whether it's spoken or written, that doesn't seem to matter at all. So back to the tree that we constructed, and I'm going to talk you through the details of the tree with a bit more detail. So the picture that emerged from this classification exercise was that the situation actually becomes simple when we let hearer knowledge occupy the dominant position. So if the referent is presented as known to the hearer, which is on the right-hand side of this plot, then a choice needs to be made between the, which is here in red, or zero here in blue. And there were very few cases where I was used, only four in total. So that's, we can kind of ignore that. We can say, in other words, that the is the default in case of hearer knowledge. For zero to be used, if the referent is presented as known to hearer, then the referent cannot be specific. All of the instances here are specificity minus, so to speak. So the referent is not specific. And that also makes sense if you bear in mind that the article the developed historically from a demonstrative. And the noun needs to be either uncountable or plural countable. If the referent on the other side, is presented as unknown to the hearer, so the left side of the tree, then a choice needs to be made between a or the zero article in blue, but there is no option for the. There were literally zero cases of the if the referent was unknown to the hearer. So in this case, we can say that a can be considered the default. Again, it's possible for zero to be used if the reference is presented as unknown to the hearer, but in that case, the noun needs to be either uncountable or plural countable. And that restriction also follows quite straightforwardly from a having developed from the numeral one historically. So one can only be used with singular countable nouns. So it seems that hearer knowledge is a very powerful predictor for article usage, and the default for either of its values, so presence or absence of hearer knowledge, is overridden in the same way. So you can use zero if the noun is singular, uncountable, or plural. And the classification also reveals that not all articles are governed by the same variables, and that not all variables occupy the same place in the hierarchy of for all articles. So if the entity is presented as known to the hearer, then this specificity of referent is more important than countability, which comes second, which in turn is more important than number, which comes third. But if the entity is presented as unknown to the hearer, then we see these variables show up in the reversed order. So number is more important than countability, which is more important than specificity of reference. So very simply put, there does seem to be a reasonably easy way to select the articles. The question you should be asking yourselves is not, am I referring to something specific, but do I think that the person I'm talking to knows what I'm referring to? And if you think that the person you are talking to knows or should know what you're referring to, then the default is the, which I put here in green, and you can only use zero, which I put in yellow, if the thing you're talking about is not specific and is uncountable or plural, such as I had some chocolate or had chocolates with my coffee. You don't need to know which ones. If you think, or if you do not think that the person you're talking to knows or could know what you're referring to, then your default is a or on here in blue. And here too, the zero can be used, but pretty much only with plural nouns such as Belgian fries or uncountable nouns like Belgian beer, for example. So what we found, what seems to be emerging is that the key to the mystery of the article use in English is the conversation partner. So the article system is a grammatical way for the speaker to keep tally of what they think the hearer should know, both in terms of familiarity and identifiability. So articles aren't just determiners. It's like a reference tracking system that allows the hearer and the speaker to calibrate the knowledge or the information that they are exchanging. I said that. So it's not a determiner, but a reference tracking system. So if we summarize what we found, then that is the English three-way article system is largely learnable from exposure using two basic experiences, which is who you are talking to, what knowledge does your interlocutor have, and what you're talking about. So important here are properties of the reference, so the number and the countability. And the trick here is that you shouldn't assume that the same principles apply across the board. So we found that the can be learned from when something is known to the hearer and the referent is specific, but a is used when the referent is generic and the number is singular, and then zero links with the two. Zero requires a plural number or uncountable thing and something that is unknown to the hearer. So this is another trick for L2 learners. Don't try and apply all of these principles in the same way to all of the articles. They each take subsets. And so partly this is the case because the discourse experience plays an important role. The hearer here is crucial. And you need to learn as a user of this article system that you are tracking a reference from your hearer's vantage point. Another dimension that plays an important role in constraining the system is the fact that, of course, it's grown historically and developed from the count noun one, which requires singular countable nouns, and zero kind of mopped up the leftovers. There is an interesting book on the development of the English article system, which basically, you know, says the same thing. So the definite article emerged in late Old English as from a demonstrative it's older, so it's more grammaticalized and should be easier to predict. The indefinite article emerged in Middle English from one, which explains why it requires singular. And then the zero was kind of left to mop up everything that the and a didn't do. And that then, of course, also explains why the zero has turned out to be more difficult to predict. So I'm going to hand over to Petter here, who can talk you through how our algorithm did when we gave it the information that turned out to be really important. So hearer knowledge and specificity of reference.
Can we take a break now, maybe?
I put
Does
a break
it make
in.
Sense? Break a little bit later.
Yeah.
Fine, either way. Happy.
It's a weird place to break.
Yeah, okay. No problem. Sorry. Okay, so many of you actually know this from our previous discussions, and this relates to Riskola-Wagner or Widderhoff, because we said those are essentially or effectively the same learning rules or algorithms. So in this case, this is just for you to remember that in a sort of a nutshell, what you typically do is you deal with, you specify what should be learning cues and what should be learning outcomes. In more traditional terminology, if we go back to Pavlovian conditioning and traditional learning, instrumental learning, and so on and so forth, they would discuss conditioned stimuli and unconditioned stimuli and conditioned response and unconditioned response. So these kind of things will be part of the vocabulary for, but in modern days, I think it's also sort of more neutral and more general. It allows you to think broader than just conditioning animals in labs. So we're talking about cues and outcomes. So what we have here, if you recall, we had the cue present. Again, recall what we said, if cue is not present, then there is no new information and basically learning does not happen, or at least change in weights does not happen. And then, or thus, learning does not take place. So everything remains the same. But if cue is present, then something happens, and it depends on what is the, whether outcome is present or not. So in the first row, if you look this small table, what you have in the first learning situation or learning event, you have A cue present and X outcome present. So it means that this association should be strengthened. This is a positive evidence. But then in the second trial, you have A and epsilon or Y, and then this association should be strengthened, but the previous one between A and X should be weakened. I can only invite you warmly. I think that we share those links to our blog, but again, you can remind you can remind yourself if you go and find our blogs about learning tomatoes and similar stuff. You can also check what we talked about on last Thursday. the difference or the interesting question from learning perspective is we have a kind of very efficient learning system, and in a way we can consider that random forests are also learning machinery, because it does give you some measure of systematic relationship in your data, or the structure, regularity, if you wish, in your data. But what we certainly know is that this is not the way humans learn, and animals, and so on and so forth. What you can use and do with computational simulation, you can basically compare. So you can allow that luxury to say, okay, I will use something that is state of the art statistical classifier, and I will also use learning algorithm that at least tries to mimic how living organisms are changing or learning, if you wish. So we had a couple of papers in the past that where we discussed this type of comparisons, and you can imagine that it would be interesting to do, I don't know, in a way, even cluster analysis can be argued that it's some way of learning. It gives you some structure back from the data, and then you try and use something that is biologically or psychologically or cognitively, if you wish, plausible or viable, and then you compare the performance. So again, as Dagmar started with that, and I think it's really interesting and important point, is that we really do not try to achieve best possible results. That's for, I would say, that's for engineering people, for people in computational linguistics, in natural language processing. They certainly would like to have the best possible classifier to do some annotation task for corpora as accurately as possible. But we are actually interested in understanding failures. And this is why this slide has this remember Yoda, because if you watch Star Wars movies, Yoda in one of the later parts of the movie said that the greatest teacher failure is. And it kind of speaks to learning in on more than one level. On one hand, we should be interested in failures because we can learn about language and language processing and language acquisition and understand that those processes better, especially if we are cognitive linguist and or usage-based linguist and or psychologist of language. We should be interested because we are interested in language use. We believe that knowledge about language comes from use. And then on the other more concrete level, these type of algorithms that Dagmar and I are using in our research, those are called error correction learning or error driven. So basically, that's how we learn in general. That's how living organisms learn. So it's in a nutshell to kind of reiterate, the Rescolo-Wagner rule defines how the system, be it an animal or human or computer, learns, not just from positive input, but in particular for errors in prediction. You remember that when we discussed those equations, there was always this comparison between, as I said, the truth, the teacher, the target, and my current prediction or system's current prediction. So any that teacher can be either present or absent, and you then need to correct your current prediction to the fact that you're making an error or you're giving or you're making incorrect prediction. In the longer run, and this is well explained in work of Vidrov and his collaborators, you try basically what you try to learn or what you do with learning as a process is you try to minimize the error in a longer run. Now, this is one simulation that we did with the Rescolo-Wagner or, as I said, Vidrov-Hopf delta rule. Those are all synonyms. We discussed that previously. What you see on this slide is how algorithm learn grammatical category of English article from exposure to naturalistic data, from the same data that we used in the corpus that we manually annotated. So we, because it's manually annotated, we can say reasonably rich knowledge because we know what is hearer knowledge in each specific example or in each specific sentence or short excerpt, specificity of referent, number, countability, and so on and so forth. So we use those. You can see among cues that we have all of those, and we also kind of entered or used this, whether the corpus data is coming from spoken or written corpora. These variables are coded in different colors, and they code both known to hear as well as unknown to hear. So known to hear would be dark blue, and unknown to hear would be known to hear is light blue, and unknown to hear is dark blue. Each panel, so we have three panels, and we are dealing separately with each possible outcome. So we have zero on the left hand side, or no article, then we have indefinite article in the middle panel, and then finally on the right hand panel we have definite article. So these are separate outcomes, and they are, so the strength of weights is normalized of between each cue and each particular outcome is normalized across three possible outcomes. So you have same values on y-axis, so we can easily compare directly the strength of our cues. And we can confirm that from this learning simulation, when we randomize those examples from our short, relatively small, manually annotated corpora, this type of learning kind of confirms which relevant dimensions are indeed relevant. So if just we compare colors, we can see that not all articles are learned from the same properties or same linguistic or language features, if you wish. And not all properties are equally important for all articles. For the definite article on the right-hand side, learning is dominated by hearer knowledge, and being known to hearer is the strongest positive cue for definite article, for the. This variable is also important, or this cue is also important for indefinite article, for if you check the mid panel, but now here it's unknown to hear. So in for the definite article, known to hear is the strongest positive cue, and then almost mirror image is unknown to hear is the strongest or comparatively strong negative cue. I mean, in absolute values, known to hear is a bit stronger. It hits the weight strength about 0.4, while on the negative side, the cue unknown to hear hits a bit less than 0.3, in fact. Then it flips for indefinite article, and then unknown to hear becomes the strongest positive cue. And it is also followed with the three other cues, being number, singularity, and countability, so countable nouns. That those three, that triple of cues is important for distinguishing or for discriminating indefinite article. So there is one positive cue for definite article, and it clearly separates itself from the others. And here we have three. So this is also one thing that I didn't point out previously. It's not just that not same cues are important for different articles. They are also not equally important, even if the same cue is important for two articles, for example. The strength is not the same. And then total number of cues can be different. And in a sense, maybe we can argue that the situation for indefinite article is slightly more complex to be learned, because you need to deal with three things rather than just one. Somehow for definite article, if it's known to hear, then more or less it's done deal. And then we have still different situation for zero article. So what's our mission again and again? We want to understand L1 language cognition better. What do language users really learn and how and know? And what should cognitive linguists focus on in all of this? So as a second goal, we can say that's to improve L2 language learning experience, which at the beginning we were often saying to make it easier, but then we corrected after many discussions that Dagmar and I had, and we said maybe perhaps not easier necessarily, because things are complex in language by definition. And as soon as you want to move away from really basic elementary knowledge into intermediate and advanced or fluent, then things are getting more and more kind of intricate and complex. So maybe not easier, but at least more natural in the sense that we really want to rely on how we learn things. So in improving language learning and in experience of experiencing outcomes, you should also remember that only 8% of languages has the article system, which means that English article system is an enormous challenge to virtually all learners of English as a foreign language, all but those that actually have articles, but that's a minority of languages. And it would be really great if the insights we have gained can be used to support the development of knowledge in foreign language learners that resembles the knowledge native speakers have. So that will make foreign language users more similar to native speakers. This is, of course, how we use our new knowledge and to offer learners shortcuts to the relevant experience and get them off to do a better start. There is another matter that perhaps it's fair to say that currently occupies a lot of discussion that Dagmar and I are having. And one of these general phenomena in learning is pre-exposure in learning. Somehow, I think that we agreed in the end. There are many definitions of pre-exposure, but again, being traditionally trained in that, we kind of ended being happy with definition that this is reduction of cue outcome systematicity. What it does is actually we can talk about different types of pre-exposure. One and common type of pre-exposure is that you have pre-exposure of cue. So somehow you experience cue, but you don't experience an outcome at the same time. And then, as they say in traditional literature, association is retarded. It can same happen if you just pre-expose and only present outcome but not cue. That can also first reduce the systematicity between cue and outcome and then affect or reduce the amount, if you wish, the amount of learning. So we can say that learning and furthermore predictivity is affected in that sense. If we simulate how L2 learners might learn articles using the three major dimensions of number, familiarity, specificity, if they were exposed to naturalistic data, then we can and use natural input, naturalistic sentence and corpus data as experienced by native speakers. Then we can also play with the proportion of how much experience a second language learner might have in particular simulation. We can easily change the order of exposition. We can play with this pre-exposure effects in various ways. We can introduce or remove certain information like number or specificity or known or unknown to hear and so on and so forth, and actually observe in advance how that affects learning. We can use iterative learning algorithms such as we do with Ryskolov-Wagner or Widerhoff. And then we can observe results and think about teaching practices. This is what we did. So this is the original first simulation run when we basically randomized trials. So there was nothing systematic in how a learner, in this case machine, acquired the information. But then we said, okay, let's play easily with this and introduce something else. Let's say that we will assume and we will maximize the connection strength between certain inputs, certain cues, and certain outcomes. as you can. I will not go into details because I think I need to speed up a little bit. As always, I talk too much. What is clear? So we still have the same order. This is the null article. This is indefinite. This is definite article. What happens here is that there is a dramatic change in how this information kicks in. In this particular simulation, I think that now we have first language that is articleless, so to say, imagine Polish or any other Slavic language, but Bulgarian. And then in the second phase, like let's say somewhere at the middle of the learning learning simulation, here and here, suddenly you have the second language, which is experienced one third of the time. So you're still two thirds of the time using your mother tongue, and then one third, which is quite generous because most of the time actually we are not learning L2. That's quite a lot. That's my point. So you have a lot of input data and a lot to learn from. So you can see that actually these new situations do not mirror at all somehow poor Polish native or Serbian native as I am, they have completely different picture of what is important and what is not. And the funniest thing of all is basically that somehow language as Q, whether it's L1 Polish or other Slavic language or L2 English, will become the most salient, if you wish, most salient Q of them all. And let's here have a short break, and then we can continue in, let's do 10 past two, okay?
Meaning? Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so Professor, shall we restart now?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you all ready?
I think yes.
Okay, and you see everything you're supposed to be seeing?
Yeah, there is a break on the PowerPoint.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's fine. Yes. So in the second part of this talk, we wanted to present to you, we may have a little too much for today, so we may need to take more questions tomorrow, but we thought it might be interesting to present the same problem from a completely different perspective. So we've been saying, you know, it's natural for people to learn from positive evidence, but also from negative evidence, basically natural for people to learn from their own errors. But as a second language learner, of course, you wonder what others think of you while you make all these errors that you need to make to learn. And especially with language, this is a very tricky area because language is a measuring stick for how competent we are at anything else. So here in Western Europe, it's generally acknowledged that everyone who's not male, who is not white, and who is not able-bodied and is a non-native speaker of language has to work harder to get to where they want to be. And there is plenty of research that has shown that non-native speakers are seen as less intelligent and as less competent, and that they are also less likely to be considered for higher status jobs than native speakers. And the really disturbing part of this is that if you label someone as a non-native speaker or as a foreign speaker, you, of course, activate all kinds of prejudices and stereotypes, but this literally happens in a split second. So one study found that judgments on whether or not a speaker is a native speaker of a language or not a native speaker are very accurate even after hearing a speech segment of only 30 milliseconds. So that is just the beginning of the T in the word to, for example. And if I just need to start pronouncing the T for a native speaker of English to be able to say that I am not a native speaker of English. And of course, with that, activate all the prejudices and stereotypes. Now there is research on error detection as well. There is, of course, we as linguists know that there is a massive amount of variation in first language use. Not everybody speaks their native tongue in exactly the same way. Not everybody uses the same constructions. And then the question is, do native speakers notice the errors that language learners make? The problem is that the literature isn't really equivocal on this point. So some of the literature has found that native speakers are more likely to detect non-native grammatical errors than native grammatical errors, and that accent has nothing to do with this. Then other research has found that native speakers seem to respond only to, for example, gender violations in native accented speech, but not in foreign accented speech. Whereas studies using the same EEG technology have then again not found any evidence of error detection in a native accent. And there's also recent work that shows that errors that are made in a non-native accent are given a more plausible interpretation. So if you are a non-native speaker of language and you make a grammatical error, then a native hearer will try to make sense of this, and they will not do so if the error is made by the same error is made by someone who speaks with a native accent. So it's kind of a mixed bag. It's unclear whether native speakers, it seems to be the case that native speakers detect non-native errors, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they react to it, so to speak. So this is something that we investigated together with one of our postdocs, Hui Sun. And the paper that we've written up is currently under review. So I will talk you through the study, and then Petter will explain the statistical analysis and the results to you. I'm going to let you listen to two short speech samples in English, one from a native speaker and one from a foreign speaker. And I would like you to consider whether you think that those speech segments are equally correct or equally incorrect, or whether one contains more errors than the other, or whether they contain the same number of errors. So this is the native speaker.
I think that culture is one of the areas most affected by globalization. It's hard to say whether it is the positive or negative impact. I think that thanks to a globalization, people all around the world listen to the same music, watch the same movies, and read the same books.
And then the non-native speaker.
The celebration of Christmas starts a week before the main event. We celebrate, we send the cards, and we go to Nativity Place. And on 25th of December, we celebrate, we have a dinner, and we meet up with our families.
So what do you think? Does one of the speakers make more or fewer errors than the other one? As you can see, the speakers both make exactly as many errors, but many people will think that the foreign speaker actually made more errors than the person speaking with the native accent. So that's the question that underlies the current study. So we manipulated how properties of the speaker and of the listener interact with properties of the language, and whether we get an effect of those factors or of those variables on whether people detect errors and how gravely they rate those errors. So we manipulated a few properties of the speaker. One was accent. So we had excerpts read by someone who has a native British accent and someone who speaks English with a Polish accent. Those speakers read both grammatical and ungrammatical fragments. So in some fragments we had article errors, whereas in other fragments there were no article errors. And then we also manipulated comprehensibility. So the comprehensibility of some of these fragments was perfect, whereas in others this was lower than less than perfect. We also recorded some properties of the listener, so to speak. And what we looked at in particular was their personality profile, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that. Then we also collected information on how familiar they were with the accent they were hearing, what their attitude was towards people speaking with a particular accent, and also how aware they were of language and the issues surrounding language. So our main task was an auditory acceptability judgment task. So the stimuli were 40 short passages of English speech. And those passages were adapted from a learner corpus that contained transcriptions of interviews with Polish speakers in English, Polish learners of English, about a variety of topics. And then, you know, we corrected the article errors in half of those fragments, and we inserted article errors in the other half of those fragments. They were then all recorded by two British speakers, or two speakers with a British accent and two people who spoke English with a Polish accent, one female, one male. So that was our accent condition. And then we had the native speakers of English, British English. We had 60 native speakers of British English. Who were balanced in gender and all had equally much exposure to a non-native accent. So they all said that they spoke with foreign learners or foreign speakers of English at least once a week. They had a varied education level, varied language learning or language teaching experience, and varied linguistic training experience. And they were asked to listen to these fragments, and then they were asked to rate from their own perspective how the language in the recording sounded to them. And they were asked to give a very low score if they felt that this was not at all how they would express themselves in English. And they were asked to give a high score if they found that, yeah, that's pretty much how I would say it myself. We also asked them to take someone else's perspective. So we asked them to take the teacher perspective. And we asked them to judge or to rate whether an English teacher would consider the language correct. And then we said, give a low score if you think that the teacher would say there are too many errors, but give a high score if you think a teacher would say, yeah, everything is the way it's supposed to be. And as I said, the stimuli were also rated for intelligibility and comprehensibility. And generally, the stimuli, people found the stimuli mostly intelligible and comprehensible. I think 99% of the ratings were above 60 out of 100, so pretty much comparable. So to hand over to Petter for the results.
Like this swapping chair, or what's the name of the game? Okay, back to me. I need to apologize once again. It took me a little bit longer to explain all the simulations that we ran, but I would be happy to take some questions on that and clarify if I was rushing over things. So anyways, for our results, again, we used, as I was explaining yesterday, these generalized additive mixed effect models. This time, it's of course not multivariate, though we had only one dependent variable at a time. But it's, as I said, it's sort of a superclass, superfamily of similar models, like regression, analysis of variance, and those types. Plus, it allows these nonlinearities, and it handles random effects really efficiently. This model for self-perspective acceptability, it accounted for more than 70% of variance. So it explained really highly. That's a really, I can't stress, I did a lot of statistics in my life, but it was quite seldom to have such a high percentage of explained variance. That's not typical in principle. So we got main effect of gender. In brief, men were judged more harshly, maybe also because we had mainly female participants or female judges. And there is a main effect of comprehensibility, which means that it's harder to understand speech that is judged more harshly. There is an effect of accent in interaction with errors, and that's on the third panel. I will talk a bit more in details about that. Errors in accented speech is judged more leniently, that means less harshly. In general, results show that native listeners tend to judge grammaticality error more severely when they appear in native speech or native accented speech than in non-native accented speech. Regardless of how comprehensible the speaker is to the listeners, attitudes, given his this listener's language attitudes and experience. In other words, non-native accent seems to protect L2 speaker or non-native speaker from being penalized too harshly for her or his grammatical errors. So this is the interaction that I was mentioning. Now this time zoomed in. So as you can see, there is more or more pronounced difference for when error is present, when in comparison when there is no error, than when we are hearing the same sentence in Polish accent. So that difference is judged less, as there is a less difference, less pronounced difference in rating for non-native speakers. What we also wanted to zoom in more detailly is this personality traits and how they kick in into ratings and how much certain personality profile will handle matters of penalization. So more generally, when we go back and think about what we are dealing with, we can say article errors are among the most frequent errors which are made by non-native speakers, but at the same time, those errors are not considered to be particularly severe. So those are possibly among the least irritating errors that non-native speaker can make. And there are plenty of studies that are discussing this point. And then what we have is this least irritating type of error. So it's relatively light type, but then the question is, what does personality can what personality can change in all of this? Do we have some personality profiles or types that are more likely to be kind of grammar police and similar? So it's in the end, as we think, because it's about communication, we need to account for both speaker accent and grammaticality as well as listener personality, because I know speaker can make can have accent, can make errors in grammatical errors, but then the listener can be very lenient and his or her personality profile can be just like not caring too much about that, while for the same amount of same type of accent, same amount of grammatical errors, certain personalities in listener can be very sensitive to those. What we tried with the probably most commonly used personality inventories, well-known Big Five instrument that basically puts you on the scale on the five major personality traits: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And we gave you a web link where you can read more about this personality. And there are also different versions of that test. We used a short version just because we didn't want to have our study lasting for too long, for too many hours. This is just one possible personality profile. So you have slightly above average openness, and then you have about the average on how much agreeable that person is, and so on and so forth. What we saw in results in that, in the case of making judgments from self-perspective, so self-perspective acceptability rating, there are three personality traits that show significant effect on acceptability ratings, but only via interaction with non-native accent. In other words, they predicted speech acceptability in the Polish accent condition. First of all, conscientious people tend to be ambitious, hardworking, quite self-disciplined, and so on and so forth. So then it's not surprising to say that listeners who are strict or stricter on themselves expect more from the speakers and find it less acceptable when speaker cannot meet the native norm. The effect of other two personality traits are those two are non-linear. So this effect of consciousness is linear. And then we have two non-linear effects for the other two. The second one, the mid panel, is extroversion. More extroverted individuals are also more likely to express their opinion freely, and then they are showing less, to be less agreeable when errors are made. It's possibly easier for more extroverted listener to point out the gap between the stimuli and the native norm in terms of accent, so that's why they're giving lower ratings. Finally, among listeners who are on the negative pole on the third panel on how much they are agreeable, we first see a less and more pronounced increase in acceptability for non-native accent speech. The less non-agreeable the listener were, the more acceptable the non-native accent speech sounded in the end. But for listeners on the positive pole, so from here, on the panel from zero, for listener on the positive pole, this dimension tend to reverse. The more extremely agreeable the listener were, the less acceptable the non-native accent speech sounded. So this is if you compare with particular personality traits, then you see where each of those kind of matches if you're above the average on the conscientiousness, then you tend to have lower scores, lower ratings in the end. This is the score for extroversion. Again, on the right-hand side, lower scores, and finally, agreeableness is somewhere around zero in this particular case. So you can always find exact relationship where the personality trait score is versus where your results will be in ratings. Then we also analyze this from, so let's say, more generally hetero perspective. So this was the self perspective rating. And then the second bit was also how I would think the teacher would judge, how much this would be acceptable for teacher, for someone else in general, but in this particular, for someone who is an expert in let's say, foreign languages. What we got is also very interesting and somehow, generally speaking, reassuring. So first of all, we got the effect of grammaticality by accent, we got the effect of speaker gender and comprehensibility. So all major players are in, but none of the listeners' personality factors improved the model fit. So they didn't contribute to prediction of the acceptability judgments for someone else. So this is interesting because it also shows that people can take different positions when they rate something, and it's not always absolute, but it can be filtered in or filtered out depending on whether I need to judge for myself or someone else. So in simple words, these results show some somehow more objective type of rating. A native listener's reaction to non-native speakers could become less biased simply by entering the communication with a less self-focused perspective. As take-home messages, we propose, so to say, overall, accent protects against penalization in listeners who are positive toward foreign accent. Certain personality traits, as a second point, negatively affect perception of errors in non-native accented speech. Native listeners are able to suppress that effect of their personality and make more objective judgment. Raising awareness of how personality influences attitudes toward non-native accent might be a useful further effect of this particular study, help attain fair treatment of non-native speakers in high-stakes situations. General conclusion, picture is quite messy. There are no clear, simple rules. Situation is also kind of eclectic. It's not designed, but it's developed. It is learnable. We need to always bear in mind why the system emerged. Why do we need to flag up whether it's known to hear or known, whether it's definite or indefinite? So this emerged from communicative situation between speaker and hearer, so dynamically in interaction. And it is developed from demonstratives and numerals. Finally, for all of us, excluding Dagmar, or for most of us, because we struggle when we use English, it's okay to make things wrong, to make errors. First of all, we will not be penalized that harshly as we would if we would be native speakers. And then in the end, practicing helps you learn. Again, greatest teacher failure is. Thank you very much. We can stop sharing.